Hey listeners, we want to give a content warning before starting the show. In this episode, we discuss a lot of difficult topics, including racial violence and genocide, torture, rape, and child abuse.
Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Jessie. And today, we're excited to talk about Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi, a story about an oppressed community in West Africa, and the girl Zelly, who is trying to save them. So, initial reactions. I absolutely loved this book. It was great. I laughed. I cried. There's so much good magic in the book, the themes. I had a lot of feelings, and I thought it was a great metaphor for the Black American experience.
I second all of those things that you just said. And what really struck me most about the novel is that it inhabits this sort of inflection point where it can contain all these conflicting energies at once, conflicting elements. So for example, it has this expansive, generous love, whether it's familial love, romantic love, or like between friends, but then that's tempered by this super dark hate that is like an abyss. And then another thing that it balances is this extreme violence and oppression, and also with the bright hope of liberation. And all of that is packaged in a compelling story with interesting characters. It's so vibrant. It really, Children of Blood and Bone sets the bar for me now, I would say, with inclusive fantasy that is just so, no words.
No words.
Let's talk about world building in our first segment called Through the Wardrobe. So the story is set in Orisha, which is a diverse and vibrant place modeled off of West Africa, and it's ruled by a ruthless monarch named Saran, who has committed genocide against the people with magic, who are called the Magi in this system.
And in this world, magic is granted from the gods, so we get this very elaborate system with different gods, 13 different gods? Was it 13?
I'm not sure. We can check.
13-ish gods. But we really mostly interact with just one of them, and that's Sky Mother, through Zelly.
And Oya, which is her deity.
Right. So I guess two. And we see oral tradition. That's how we learn about the different gods, is through this oral tradition. And I wasn't sure in the book whether that oral tradition came as a part of their culture or as a part of them as being like an oppressed group, the Magi and the diviners. What did you think?
I think that their ritual language is Yoruba for all of the incantations, and that had been banned. So I wouldn't be surprised if all of that history would have been banned or censored.
Right.
Or, like, books burned.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Burning lots of books.
Mm-hmm.
So the diviners are the people who are alive right now, and so no one has magic at the time mm-hmm. when the story starts. We see Zelly meet Amari, and that's when magic starts making its comeback in this community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one person in the family, not always a whole family of magi. So Zelly's brother,
Zane,
doesn't have magic, and neither does her father, but her mother did.
It's kind of hard to talk about the world without talking about the magical system, because the magical system is what makes this world so vibrant. I guess there's a lot of geographical diversity.
Yeah.
We see a lot of different, like, ecosystems. We see the desert of Ibeji. We see the Gombe River Valley. We
right.
see Chandomblé. And the map was very helpful. Because when I first listened to this on an audiobook, I was very disoriented.
Yeah, I referenced back to the map a few times. And we also meet someone who's from outside of the region in Rowan. He's from a place that's not on our map at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously something going on outside of this world, and I wonder if they have magic as well.
I wouldn't be surprised, and I think that I I think it's very likely that Children of Virtue and Vengeance, which is book two that Adeyemi is currently writing, expands the world.
Right.
And we find our characters elsewhere outside of Orisha.
Do you think we'll go to wherever Rowan's from?
I think we might. Mm. I'm not sure.
I kind of liked him.
I did too. He was one of my faves.
Yeah, agreed. So this world also has state-sanctioned slavery that they call the Stocks. And in the Stocks, people are forced to do work. They're not paid for it, and it's based on them not being able to pay their taxes. So we saw this kind of similar as modern-day criminal justice system. So they are also often forced to do work. They don't get the same wages as everyone else would normally. So if you haven't watched The 13th, a documentary that's on Netflix, I would highly recommend it. It really does a good job of explaining how prison is modern day slavery.
Yeah. And reading this book, I realized that I have a lot more learning and research to do. I mean, I've done some, but I really need to read up, like read The New Jim Crow. Right. And there's so many, I think what, the sort of cultural production you're exposed to a lot of times can be limited racially.
Yes.
Especially like as a white person who grew up in a predominantly white area, like 90, we're talking like 98% white people.
Or even like in documentary, like you don't see that many documentaries about black people and the black experience. Mm-hmm. I guess there's the new Trayvon Martin documentary, which I haven't watched yet either.
I haven't seen that one.
It's called Rest in Power. I think it's a like 6-part documentary.
Wow.
On BET. Wow. But you do maybe need to be in the right mind space sometimes to watch those kind of things, because they can be very difficult to watch, I think.
Definitely. And we'll talk all about this more in our One Does Not Simply section, but
this and a lot more.
So much more.
Wands out. So another big part of this world is people who accept and fear the gods are the diviners and the magi, as opposed to the monarchy and the Kosidon, who we don't really see practicing religion. I don't know that they don't, but we don't see that in the community.
Because we access the story through young people's perspective,
right?
The raid happened 13 years ago, 11 years ago. And during the raid, because religion and magic are so tied together, the king severed the tie with the gods, which then broke magic and took magic away. But another part of that was taking religion away.
Right. And we see that when Inan is talking about how he like followed the advice of his father. And so his father said that the gods don't exist. So Inan believed that they didn't exist until his dad told him otherwise.
Right, exactly.
So I don't know. Maybe there are some Kosidon who do believe in the gods. Obviously, I would think that Zane has to, because he's seen his mother and sister do magic.
Yeah, I think that if you see and accept magic not as like a virus or a curse, then you would have, like, it's physical proof.
Right.
It's like manifesting the god's power.
Right.
It's like climate change. It's not a question of believing it. It's like happening.
Right. Exactly. Oh, I guess it's kind of similar to miracles.
Okay.
So
maybe.
Like if you think about the Bible, the people who are witnessing miracles would be kind of difficult to, if you looked at the Bible and thought it was true. The people witnessing miracles in that time would think that whatever religion is making those miracles happen must also be true.
Are you saying the Bible's fantasy, Jesse?
I'm saying it should be read as literature and only as literature. I wouldn't read it as like a textbook. If it were me, it's up. Everyone has their own choice. So going along with talking about religion, one of the biggest problems I had with this novel as a whole was the religious aspects. I thought that it felt like a lot of the magic in this book and the way that religion worked in this book felt like it stemmed from Christianity. Now, I should mention, I grew up in a Christian household as a child. I don't believe in those things, but that probably colors my perspective a bit because that's all I've ever known as a child. But it was weird to me that they both believed in free will and predeterminism. And we see this in Mama Agba's vision, where Zelly is both concerned that she has to fulfill this destiny that's meant for her, but at the same time, she's also worried that it's not gonna, what they want her to do isn't gonna work, which is strange to me in that I don't know how you can hold those beliefs at the same time, but also feels like something or a story you would read in the Bible where someone says, I'm not sure I believe in what God wants me to do, but I have to do it because he, she, they say so.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Can you talk a little bit more about why you think that this magical system / religion is influenced by Christianity?
Yeah, sure. So I think that a lot of what reminded me of Christianity is the belief in heaven and hell and what determines how you get there, even though this story takes a really dark turn on how you get to hell, because if your death was painful and agonizing, that's when you end up in the bad place in this world. I forget what it was called. I'm just going to call it the bad place. And so that was really weird to me.
Because it didn't have anything to do with like baptism or being accepting God and then being prepared to go to heaven no matter what.
Right.
It was more the material part of your death, life and death was more important.
Right. And in this story, we don't really see anything similar to Christianity in that there's like a savior, unless you see Zelly as a savior to the people. She doesn't have to sacrifice herself. But
she almost does.
Yeah, she almost does. And so I feel like the book almost turns her into a Jesus-like figure.
She is messianic, right? Because she's singled out as like the only one who can do this, who can fulfill this. Like ritual, who can do the ritual? Well, and she, the narrative makes her the only one,
right?
Because she's the only one who the Centauro. What's his name?
Lekan.
Oh, Lacan. Lacan.
Yeah. Okay.
She's the only one that Lacan has performed the ritual, reconnecting her to Sky Mother.
Right.
So she has like her channel. We call it her channel. Her channel to Sky Mother is now open, so that's why she's fully be able to become a Magi.
Which is also similar to what. In, like Catholicism, where it's the priests who have the direct channel to God, and they're the only ones that can connect with God. And so Zelly is the only one who can connect with the gods and not anyone else, which is also interesting.
Yeah, she's definitely chosen one, sort of singled out. And we see that chosen one thing, that movement happen a lot in YA.
Right, even Harry Potter.
But it's not as explicitly religious.
As in this book.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the magical system is so tied to the religious system.
Right. And I think we see a lot in this book with Zelly, like, struggling with her belief in the gods. Like, she never stops believing in them, but at the same time, she does struggle with her journey with the gods. So she's, why was I chosen? Why do I have to be the one to do this? That sort of thing. And that felt very tied up in Christianity to me. What did you think?
I didn't quite have the same take on the religious aspect. I thought that it was actually really powerful to have an explicitly non-secular magical system that uses ritual, and it's almost not witchy.
But more similar to witchcraft.
Right, to like the actual craft, you know, the incantations and the like rites of passage, those sorts of things. What I liked about it is that this book is so invested in representing blackness in all of the nuance and complexity that it deserves. And I think that by making the magical system tied to religion, it's actually like a revindication of all of the oppression that has happened to those communities with white settler colonialism and the slave trade, which, and you had written down in the show notes that the difference between the diviners and the African Americans, that the diviners were not forced into a religion of the people who enslaved them. So the colonizing of people's minds and belief systems is absolutely fundamental right. for white supremacy as we know it today. And I think that this repurposing of religion, using polytheism, using the like feminine sky mother, like changing the God from being a patriarchal figure to a matriarchal figure, and it just gives this sensation that like blackness isn't just powerful,
right?
It's actually fucking transcendental and right. magical.
No, I definitely agree. And I guess it's hard because so many, I think that a lot of Christianity is obviously stolen from paganism. That's just, sorry if you didn't know that, but, you know, so maybe it's partly because what has been so entrenched in my life has been Christianity that I see that first.
Because you personally are resistant to that.
Right, especially having grown up going to very different churches, Catholic Church and like Black Baptist Church with my Black side of my family, they're very different. And this religion that the Magi and the diviners have in this story seems so similar to like Black Baptists that I was reminded of those times that I had been in those ceremonies or those churches or those like not masses, but services. And because it's like a more joyful kind of Christianity than you normally see.
It's more celebratory and yes. laudatory instead of punitive.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of singing and clapping and dancing, like in the worshiping parts, that this really reminded me of that.
One thing that I think can revindicate this and certainly separates it from Christianity in particular is that it does not seem to be a missionary religion at all. It's not about evangelizing people.
That's true.
It's more, I would say that this religious system is actually like made material with the manifestation of magic. It's proof, essentially, right. quote unquote, right. that the gods exist and that just, I mean, because it's a fantasy novel with magic in it, like magic actually exists in this system yeah. and it's not a secular system. Like we see in Harry Potter or Tamara Pierce or Lord of the Rings or the Grishaverse or Sarah J. Maas
right.
or a lot of your other fantasy books.
Yeah, because even in other fantasy books, you do see them talking about the gods or God or like in Sarah J. Maas, like the cauldron.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't feel as tied up in today's religion as this felt to me. But I think like some of that's on me, you know, so... Yeah.
It's definitely a foundational part of this world and the magical system.
Do you think that there's a hierarchy among the different types of magi?
I didn't get the sense that there was a hierarchy, and I honestly didn't even think about it until you posed this question to me. And now I'm realizing that that's really surprising. The lack of hierarchy is quite important, like quite telling. And I think it's because I'm so used to making value judgments and categorizing things into hierarchies, like thanks capitalism. But
right.
But we see it in so many fantasy books, like in Harry Potter, there's people, the hierarchy of the different houses in Hogwarts is
even like divination being like worse, like the worst magic you could study over like potions or transfiguration.
Right. Everyone is making value judgments and like slotting things up or down based on these different arguments that they're making. And it's kind of like, don't yuck my yum. Just leave me alone. Let me like what I like.
Yeah, exactly.
And why can't we appreciate the different characteristics that make these, that distinguish all of these various houses or types of magic? Like in the Grishaverse that we just talked about for the last episode, there's a hierarchy under the Darkling system, right. Between the different types of Grisha. I think this ties, the fact that there's not a hierarchy between the Magi that I can tell, or that the book really tries to force on the reader, is actually points to this bigger thing going on in the book as a whole, which is talking about difference without like pigeonholing different types of Magi or different types of people. And talking across it rather than just alighting it and pretending like difference doesn't exist, like that whole colorblind bullshit. I don't see color. No, listeners, we see color.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't, that's a lie.
That's a thing that this magical system does really well. It resists that stratification by typecasting different kinds of magic or different kinds of magi. Instead, celebrates the differences and the different things that these various magi bring to the table, their powers.
Yeah, I felt like the only person we did see Inan kind of making some judgments based on the magic they had, and then Zelle kind of towards the end thinking like, what would be the point of being like a cancer, because all you do is hurt people. But other than that, I didn't really see much of this,
right?
Like deciding who's better, who's worse within them.
I think that the book kind of lets the reader pick which ones they identify with,
right?
Versus like Harry Potter, for example, forces Gryffindor way harder than other.
It's because Gryffindor houses is the best. Just saying.
You're biased.
I'm a Gryffindor. What am I going to say?
Exactly that.
I know. That's what I'm supposed to say, right?
And in that way, I like the freedom that the magical system in this book gives the reader to identify kind of how they want to, how they see fit.
And we kind of learn about them kind of in very slowly, like the different types of magi. Like, I know there's the list at the beginning where it talks about the different kinds, but we don't really have any reason to rank them when we start.
And actually, now that I think about it, the fact that Zaylee is a Reaper, if we didn't get the story from her point of view, if we didn't have access to her point of view, we might see that type of magi with the same lens that we see like a Cancer, like not as easily able to see the positive aspects of that particular power.
Right, that makes sense.
So if perhaps we had the novel from the point of view of a Cancer, you would have the revindication of those powers.
Yeah, because I kind of wonder, what can a Cancer do other things?
I don't know.
Other than hurt people?
Can they take people's pain away? Can they make dying easier?
Right. Is that what the Reapers do?
I think the Reaper is more about the spirit.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And shepherding the spirit to the afterlife, okay, and releasing them.
So I guess they kind of make your afterlife easier, make sure you get where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hades.
Or like, who's on the River Styx?
Persephone?
No, it's the, like, the boatman who goes across the river, who shepherds the souls across the River Styx to get into Hades.
Yeah.
Mythological. Listeners with mythological knowledge, at us, please.
Yeah, I really like Greek mythology, so I also kind of thought about that with this book, because I know Greek mythology has way more than 12, 13 gods, but I really liked the different attributes of the gods and how they were born from one, and kind of like you see in Greek and Roman mythology. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, there is a whole pantheon that is related in the hereditary sense.
Right, right, exactly. And I really enjoyed that. I thought that was great.
Wands away. Jeez, Supreme Leader Snoke, get out of my room! Gosh! Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment we're calling Get Me Kylo Ren.
I think in this novel, Sauron and white supremacy are kind of mixed together as the villains in this book. I know there are no white people in this book, and that's not a bad thing.
That's great.
It's great. You say it's great, so then I think it's great. Like, you know, people say reverse racism, which I don't believe in.
Which
either
doesn't exist.
It does not exist.
Bias exists.
Bias. But racism is bias plus power. So
get racism together, is the system of oppression.
Yeah. I can't oppress you, Kelly. I'm so sorry. Anyway, so to me in this novel, Sauron was the depiction of what white supremacy looks like in our world. And I think that played a huge role in this novel as the villain. It's a very brutal villain, uncaring, unempathetic. We do get the feeling that maybe he loved his first family. And maybe he loved the Admiral, General.
Kia. He definitely loved, they were in love.
But he doesn't care about his children he has now. He's willing to kill both of them to make sure magic doesn't exist in this book.
And I think we should recap and say that the reason Saran is so anti-magi, anti-magic, is because this Kosidan Magi conflict had kind of came to a peak when he was king and his family was killed by Magi. We get a little bit of that backstory. His first family, and he calls them weak and unable to protect themselves, which is why he...
Anan calls them weak and unable to protect themselves. And
Amari also, right? I almost said Tambien. Spanish mode.
Yeah, Amari also calls them weak.
Because that's the narrative they've been given by their father.
Right, and I'm wondering if in the next novel we'll find out that's not actually how his first family died. Like, you know how in modern times we hear about, like, the problem, like, the war on drugs and the crack epidemic within Black people. And then it turns out, like, some of that problem was created by the government or were lies. So I'm wondering if this was his way of getting rid of magic for a different reason.
Like a justification?
Right. Or if it's not true.
I'm not sure. I think it could go either way. I think it's very convincing that he would take this one thing that happened and conflate it with an entire group, the Magi, and then use that as an excuse to commit genocide, essentially.
Right.
And I want to go back to the weakness part, the fact that Amari and Anand seem to think that their father's first family was weak. Like, if by weak you mean that you didn't make your 8-year-old children fight each other with swords in the basement, then I think pretty much every family would be considered weak. And that's just fine.
Right. There's a lot of child abuse going on in this book. And it's part of the reason we see Anan and Amari. Amari doesn't trust Anan, which turns out to be totally valid. But part of that is that they're both always trying to please their father, and in that they are always pitted against each other. So Amari thinks that Anan is going to betray them, and he does, but he does it because having the respect and love of his father is more important to him than anything else. Because
he's so fucking brainwashed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And abused.
But that's what abusers do, you know? Right. They make you think that there's no other way. There's nothing else that can be done.
I think it demonstrates very well the cycle of abuse and the cycle of violence and how it continues and how abusers, like, that continues then with your children.
Right, because you have to make a very concerted effort not to become your parent sometimes, especially when you have abusive parents who are... And we see this even with Amari's and Anand's mother. She's emotionally abusive to Amari. She doesn't physically hurt her, but emotional abuse is also, like, not something you should be doing to your children.
I mean, I think that we get a hint that maybe there was some physical abuse, because Amari talks about she can still remember the feeling on her skin of the last skin lightening treatment that her mother made her do.
Right.
We do get a hint that there was some physical abuse as well. And this is a huge part of the novel, and it's this, and the concept of villainy and conflict is who bears the responsibility for healing after trauma. And we see that it's the brunt lies with the children, and it's Zaylee and Zane, whether that's them recovering after the or dealing with the trauma of their father, who was beaten, like, essentially the victim of police brutality, or their mother, who was lynched.
Right.
And killed for being a Magi. So they're doing that work, and Amari and Zane are doing the work of dismantling the genocidal system that their father put in place.
Right. Which is also probably how it works in the real world. I don't think a lot of times when you come from an abusive household that your parents think they did anything wrong. And so the children end up having to either figure out a way to deal with that or, you know, they continue the cycle.
Yeah, there's very little middle ground there. Very little room to just move on. Right. The active work of healing is really important.
Yeah. And we see that a little bit where at the end, or closer towards the end of the book, Zelly goes and talks to Amari about how she doesn't have her magic anymore. And it's a good piece of advice. Find someone you can talk to when these kind of things are happening, because that's really important to the healing process.
I think that's when Zaylee really starts growing.
Right.
Is when she finally can connect with Amari.
Right. And realizing that, you know, just because someone's parent is a hateful, awful piece of shit, like, that doesn't mean that their kids are also going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids are an opportunity to change. And I know parents, maybe there are parents listening and you disagree, but I think a lot of times parents want something better for their kids. And so we see that kind of.
Sometimes that means not being like you.
Yeah, parents. Exactly. And which I think a lot of parents don't understand.
It's hard.
Yeah. Because, I mean, isn't that part of the reason you have kids? Is because you want a little you. And so I think that the brunt of that, the weight of that falls on the children. And it's just really unfortunate.
And that's certainly what we see happening with Anand.
Right.
Saran wants a little him.
Yeah.
And
he gets that.
He does. What I want to mention, the pawn as a symbol of how Saran views all other human beings.
Oh,
they are specifically for their use in his larger game that he's playing against magic. And Anand is no exception.
No.
And the fact that the pawn is made out of magicite, and we find that out later. Ugh. And then I was rereading the book for the episode, and I didn't notice the first time I had contact with this book, but it stings, and Anand mentions how it stings again and again and again from the very beginning of the book before we even know that he is magi and that he is that magicite is like hurts him particularly.
Yeah, it was funny because I wrote down in my notes pretty soon after we see Anand has this like weird connection with Zelly, but he doesn't know why, like after they like make eye contact because he brushed up against the scroll, like I wrote down in my notes, he's obviously a magi. I was like, this,
you knew it?
I was just like, he has to be, right? Like, what else?
I didn't see that coming until he started like smelling her soul essence.
Oh, then it was like, yeah.
Is that what you would describe his power as?
Yes. But he...
It's a smell, but also of a color.
Like an aura. But it's...
The sea salt smell of her soul. Oh my gosh. But alliteration. Also, that's beautiful.
It is. But also interesting because he doesn't talk about it with anyone else. So I do think there is supposed to, like, we're supposed to see this connection between the two of them that is more than just him recognizing the power in her. Because he doesn't even see it with the other diviners. But I guess he doesn't meet any other full-blown magi.
He's very much the... He does a similar cognitive movement that his father does, where his father looks at this one violent incident that happened with magi and expands that to the whole group. Anand actually has this positive interaction with Zaylee, but can't extend that generosity of spirit to the rest of her group.
Right. And we kind of see Zaylee kind of like turn around a little bit, where she starts to think maybe everyone shouldn't have these powers, because she sees the one person like turn into flames, and she's worried, like, if power's in the wrong hands, then what happens? But that's always the case with power, really. We see it with Saran. He is in power. It's obviously in the wrong hands. So what are, you know, you have to let people decide.
Yeah, if you don't want to control people entirely, there is that risk.
Right. And if you do, then you're Saran.
Exactly.
So those are your options. Let people decide and make their own decisions, or you become the thing that you hate.
And that's where I think education plays a crucial part, where you can teach people to be able to talk across difference and appreciate others. And but at the same time, anytime you have a world with haves and have-nots, there's inevitably going to be conflict.
Yeah, and it's hard to empathize, I'm guessing, as the people who have the privilege, right? So it's harder for them to know what it feels like to be in those situations if they've never felt other before. I don't know. Yeah, that's difficult.
Yeah.
Like, how do you teach someone what it's like to be Black? You know?
I would say, for me personally, it means educating myself and learning and reading and watching and listening, honestly, and not taking up airtime that's not mine, not telling stories that aren't mine.
Right. I guess that is a little bit the power of books, and maybe that's what we're supposed to see in the scroll a little bit. Because, I mean, a scroll is essentially something that they used to use for books, and Anand destroys it. He burns it.
That's a really good point, because that's actually, the scroll is the thing that like ignites and starts this whole process. And I think once you start learning and expanding your worldview and your perspective to include those other experiences, then it explodes the confines of your brain and your ability to empathize with others. And
it's the power of reading.
Exactly.
Yeah, read books about people who don't look like you.
They're magical.
It's really important.
I want to go back to Anand for a second and talk and just give props, because he is such a beautifully crafted character. He's so complicated. He's so like gut-wrenching. To me, he was the character that I found most compelling, magnetic.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I've seen that much nuance and thoughtful character development in a villain in a YA book.
And I think it's because he's a villain we're supposed to learn to love, and then like he breaks our heart. Like
he does. It's heartbreaking at the end.
I was just like, he's not gonna do it. Like, no. Like, I couldn't believe it.
Well, you're hoping.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, I mean, hope is good, but it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. It's a risk.
Yeah, it is, and I mean, it's one worth taking, but. Yeah, when he told his dad, I was heartbroken.
Yeah. And on a more theoretical level, I read Anand as a demonstration of how oppressor and oppressed can exist in a single person, because he's a magi, but he's also the prince and heir to a throne who tries tirelessly to please his tyrant father, who loathes, and that person, his father, loathes with every fiber of his being what Anand is. And Anand has internalized that, because he talked about his magic as being a virus and a curse. And it was some of the hardest passages for me to read, because his self-loathing is so apparent. And I just think Adeyemi did an excellent job crafting this character.
Yeah, and especially when you think about it as the magic being a metaphor for Blackness, it is awful and heartbreaking to think of people who they wish they weren't Black because of the experiences they've lived, or because they think it's a bad thing. I think the author does a great job of showing like the two sides of that, of how it is, there are bad experiences to be had, but it is also so beautiful. Like, there is a culture there. Like, there is so much there. So I think she did a really great job with Anand, but it was like it heart-wrenching.
He was, yeah, such a powerful character.
Agreed.
I got the sense after reading this book that ideology and hate speech and systems are the true villains in this book and in any world, that Saran is the ultimate product of these pernicious and hard to identify undercurrents that are always at work, and he's certainly responsible for awful, terrible atrocities such as the raid. But the acts of a single person cannot have far-reaching effects without, on one hand, material/financial resources and cultural clout granted by monarchy in the first place. And on the other hand, it's not possible, or the inaction of the majority makes Saran and his reign of terror possible. And I hope that white people who read this book are reminded that inaction is unacceptable.
Yeah, it's really not helpful to anyone. I mean, it's hard because then you get to keep your privilege. But in order to have a better, more peaceful society, some people have to give some things up.
Absolutely.
And that means giving up like a piece of your privilege to make sure other people can live a peaceful, happy life.
In the wake of Nia, I'm not sure how I pronounce her name, sorry, Wilson's death,
yep,
in Oakland, I came across an excellent piece about spending your privilege that we can link to in the show notes. And that really, I think, articulates very well what I believe the white people really need to do, or people with privilege need to do in this situation.
Yeah, I agree. So we see a mass genocide in the book, and something that I think can help some people relate, because the genocide is based on how people look and their religion, is that's what happened in Nazi Germany. Like, people were taken to camps, like people were taken to the stocks, and they were forced into labor. And so sometimes I think we see this like coming together of Black and Jewish people. So I think people should realize like these things happen to white people too sometimes. We interrupt these deep cuts to bring you Show Us Your Fix. Which character do you think deserves their own storyline? Let us know by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at JKMagicPod. So for me, there wasn't many characters in this book whose backstory I wanted to know more about. I think they did a good job with the multiple point of view. Maybe it would have been good to see more of Anand, like, as a good person.
He has a very small window.
Yeah.
Where that happens.
That's probably part of the problem. Maybe seeing more magic outside of Orisha. I think you couldn't have done it in this book because that wasn't the point. But I think in future books I'd like to see more of that.
I had this moment when I was reading the part where Lacan, the Centauro, essentially does the, like, mural, animates this mural in the temple at Chandomblé and tells the story of Sky Mother and the creation of all the gods. It's just so visually compelling that I would love if we got this story, Tales of Beetle the Bard style,
as a one-off.
Yeah, if Adeyemi would write the story of Sky Mother and the creation of the gods in more detail, and then if we also had it released with full color illustrations.
Or can we have like a video, like a movie, like in the style of the Tale of the Three Brothers?
Oh my gosh, that would be so...
I would really enjoy that. That would
be amazing.
Because each of the gods, I'm sure, has like a more entailed story than we get in that mural animation, that it would be cool to learn more about them.
That'd be so cool. Mm-hmm. And I know the book has already been optioned for movies, so we might very well see that happen. But I think the movies are a few years out.
Okay, back to the deep cuts, because one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. I'm going to start us off talking about race, because I had a lot of thoughts reading this book.
And I am going to defer to you, and also, listeners, if I fuck up, please hold me accountable.
That goes for both of us. I should say, I think I said in the last episode, I'm half white, so I definitely benefit from what Black people call light skin privilege. So same here. Let us know if we say anything that you don't agree with or that you think we should know more about.
Please let us know. We're open to it.
Yes. Thank you. So speaking of light skin privilege, colorism is something that comes up in this book. We see that Amari's mother is bleaching her skin. She is wearing makeup to make her look lighter, so that to set her apart from what they call like the lower classes. So like Zele is obviously darker. Zane is obviously darker, which is interesting that we see this in a book with no white people.
Yeah, that is interesting. Maybe it points to the fact that that white supremacy is internalized.
Right. I wonder if we see colorism in nations where, Well, I don't know that there exists a place where colonialism hasn't, like, touched it, you know? So I wonder if pre-colonialism, is there...
Is there still the valuing of lightness over darkness?
Right. Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I know that in some countries, like Brazil, there is this sense of colorism, even though the majority of people are darker.
And in India, for example, too. Right. Like the caste system,
yeah. So I wonder if
that... Which is different than... We should get that out. Yeah. Because it's like, that's obviously very different.
Right.
But there is... Colorism exists, I know, in non-majority white places as well.
Right. And I just wonder how colonialism has affected that. Like, was it there before then? But we do get a lot of it in this book.
Particularly at the beginning with Amari in the scenes with Amari in the castle.
And I don't remember the girl's name, but there's the girl who her mother says, you're looking really good recently, or something to that effect, to say... And Amari points out, like, in her exposition that the girl is lighter because she's been bleaching her skin.
Mm-hmm. And then Amari's mother, the queen, makes a comment about how Amari looks like she just came in from sunbathing.
Right.
In the pool.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, it's really strange because they also use white to mark people as other. So the diviners have white hair. So it's interesting that then the monarchy would also want to be lighter.
Yeah, there's this cognitive dissonance there that I don't think the book resolves, and I'm not sure how to resolve it either. The white hair of the diviners marks them as other. That's certainly true. And in that way, it kind of takes our current situation and turns it on its head, because black and dark is the default. And then, gasp, there are explicit descriptions of skin color and of dark skin color in very, like, laudatory ways, celebrating dark skin. Because Zaylee talks about her mother's dark skin glowing. And it's just these, yeah, celebration is the word I would use. Yeah,
which I loved. Because we don't see that in books in fantasy written by white people very often, where we'll see, well, someone was olive skinned, and that, you know, we see that with Katniss, and so then there's this like argument over what means olive skinned, like what
Italian,
yeah, which is, I just assume it's a white person, even though that doesn't
tan.
Make sense.
It's interesting that white people want to be tan, but at the same time white supremacy still upholds lightness, right, as better than darkness.
I know, dark we skin. See it less now. I remember, like, when I was in high school, like, a bajillion years ago. Really, like, 10 years ago. But, like, people would go to, like, tanning beds and stuff to get tanner, more tan. And it is interesting that they would want to be darker, but obviously wouldn't want to be black.
Because the dark skin, at least in, like, historically, especially in the Western world, was a sign of class also, right? It meant you had to spend more time outside and you had to work.
Right. Right. So it's interesting that we see that, like, in our generation, not in our generation, but, like, in the current day, that we see people who want to be tan, but there's obviously a line that can't be crossed, because you don't want to be too dark, then people start saying things about you, you know, even as a white person, like, you can't be too tan.
Yeah, you do get judged if you go too far that way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's like, white people have that choice. That's part of their privilege,
well, yeah,
right?
They do have a choice.
Is because they get to be like, oh, I'm going to go to a tanning bed. And that also gets to be, the tan gets to be, I guess I would say white people are allowed, in the context of white supremacy, white people have more bandwidth. Like, they have more options.
Right.
Of acceptable.
Right.
As far as skin color.
Yeah.
I think we can connect this colorism and skin color conversation with the hairstyles, curly hair versus straight hair in the book.
Yeah, you know, I know I wrote this down and I was like thinking about this, but I don't know what Amari's hair looks like. Does she have straight hair?
It doesn't describe. It doesn't describe the hair. The narrative voice makes sure to describe Zaylee's transformation from having straight white hair,
right,
to curly hair. Mm-hmm. And it's, at first it's wavy when she first starts using her magic, and then it gets super, 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 like,
coily.
Coily, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
When she uses her magic more, which I thought that was so powerful, because not only is, because it means that coily hair, like black hair, is literally a sign of Zaylee's power.
Right. Which I really loved as someone with curly hair. And it's interesting because there's like a lot to do with hair in black culture. And I would recommend, if you haven't seen it, to watch the Chris Rock documentary about hair. It's called Good Hair, I think. But it kind of walks you through the culture of black hair and weave and cornrows and like doing the relaxers in your hair to get straight hair. But it's interesting to me because that is a choice that black people make, to either have relaxed straight hair or to have curly hair.
But it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, sort of. You're judged from all mm-hmm. sides.
Yeah, because there's also an argument in the black community about whether someone like me, who is mixed, has the right to talk about how natural hair is better, because it's so much easier for me to straighten my hair than someone who is more than half black. And natural hair has become so popular, and I think part of that is light skin privilege, with people like Zendaya and Yara Shahidi and Amandla Sternberg. She's playing Star in The Hate U Give. But we have
are those all mixed race actresses?
And yeah, those are all mixed race actresses, and you know, they get more roles in movies.
I hadn't thought about it. Thought about that.
Yeah, like on the cover of The Hate U Give, I was reading an article about this recently. Star is portrayed as dark, and the actress that is playing her is mixed race. So the argument of curly versus straight hair, there's a lot of tension there about what's right. And like, for a black person to switch from, you know, doing relaxers to curly hair, they would have to like shave their hair. So
it's a personal choice that's also inherently political.
Right.
And overtly, it's because it's a visible choice, because it's so visible mm-hmm. that it's automatically judged from people both inside and outside of the community.
Yeah, especially when you think about the people who have been forced to straighten their hair for jobs, to be cheerleaders for NFL sports teams. You know,
or the like, can I touch your hair? No.
No, you cannot. Please don't touch my hair. You can ask. Actually, I don't care, but most people don't want you to touch them in general.
It's rude.
It is rude. It's fine if I know the person, a stranger. The answer is no.
Where do you get off?
Yeah, you can't touch me at all. Also read You Can't Touch My Hair by Phoebe Robinson. It's great.
I have to read that.
Yeah, would highly suggest. But there's a lot of tension there, and I'm not sure what to make of it. Tomi Adeyemi has
locks.
Yeah, and I think in the picture for
they're
her,
gorgeous.
Yeah, they are.
Her hair is so beautiful.
Yeah, and in her picture for Children of Blood and Bone, she has big, voluminous, curly hair.
Like Zoo when they get to the colony in the Gombe.
Yeah, exactly.
She's like, it almost describes it as like a halo, like a puff.
Like it's her crown, which is like kind of how in black culture we see our hair. Like it's the thing that we have control over. So it's like your crown. That's your hair. I don't know that it should hold so much importance, because it's also like the straightening of our hair is something we've done to assimilate more with white people. And I don't know that that's a good thing. But maybe that's my light skin privilege talking. I don't know.
I think it's maybe originally it started that way.
Yeah, I don't think it is now.
And I think that maybe the next movement will be to just letting people make their own decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. They're inherently tied up in a history of oppression based on race.
Exactly. Well, and then we see like, oh, they're boxer braids now. You know, those things get stolen and appropriated by white people. Dreadlocks, protective hairstyles.
Yes.
And that's also frustrating that they're not okay until a white person does it. So that's also frustrating.
Absolutely. Makes me very mortified that me getting braids when I was like 11 going to Florida was like an okay thing.
Your 11-year-old self didn't know, but we live in Boulder, Colorado. The like, amount of white people I see with dreads every day.
But like, I would never, like, it's mortifying now.
Yeah. But
because it's actually, but it's appropriative, not right. just because like, oh, I regret that time I got bangs. It's
never regret your bangs.
It's actually a sign of white privilege because it's right. like, oh, this is mine now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
But an 11-year-old isn't.
They don't know.
I don't know.
They don't know. You didn't know.
I guess you don't have to give an 11-year-old me a free pass.
I'm giving 11-year-old
you now. I'm curious. It really makes me wonder. I have no recollection of this whatsoever. But who the person who was doing the braiding?
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
Damn.
Like, do they think like, God, another white person getting braids?
Probably.
You know. But that's also like, that's their job. Like, that's how they make money. So like, it's also that's the hard part about hair is it's tied up in like consumerism.
Yeah, it's an industry.
Yeah. So what do you do then?
People are making money off of you no matter what choices you make about your hair.
Yeah, exactly. Because that was part of the argument with people talking about biracial and mixed people embracing their curly hair. And I'm saying embracing lightly. It's just the hair I have. But now there's so many products. Like, when I was a kid, there was nothing. Like, we put detangler in my hair, and my mom brushed my hair because my mom's white. She doesn't know, you don't brush your hair. Like, curly hair doesn't get brushed unless you have conditioner in it. So, like, does the rise in the amount of biracial people and multicultural people, is that why there's these products now?
I think it also comes from more people of color having, like, starting businesses and actually making products for them, like, for them, by them.
Yeah, that's true. For us, by us.
This is a good segue to the next point we want to talk about, which you brought up. Do you want to start?
About Anon.
About laws against intermingling.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, obviously, I'm still a mixed person talking, but yeah, there was a lot in the book about the, there wasn't a lot, but Zelle talks about the laws against intermingling of types of people. So this was the Kosodan and the Diviners.
Or Magi.
Yeah, or Magi, which is interesting because her is her dad a Kosodan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Her Baba and Zane are both Kosodan.
Interesting. Okay, so, but we see this abuse of power coming from the guards who represent police officers, the rape of the people in the stocks by their slave owners, and that led me to thinking about like the children who are born of rape, the children who are born, I guess, like Zelle, who's like, she is born of two people who aren't allowed to be together now,
but those laws didn't exist at the time.
Yeah, and led me to think about South Africa during apartheid and whether or not the children born of Kosodan and Diviners or Magi were considered illegal. What do you think?
I think that's very likely. I don't know if they retroactively made them illegal. Like, they would go back and check Zaylee's ancestry and then make her illegal.
I guess how would they know?
After the fact. Maybe they have a register or, like, a census or something. I don't know.
Because, like, Zane is the product of a Magi and a Kosodan and you can't tell by looking at him.
I think it's because we're the magical power or lack thereof is the defining aspect, not right. like skin color.
Yeah, exactly.
In the case of a mixed, like, black and white relationship. Which also, to be fair, the children of those relationships, like, there's a whole range of the phenotypes they can display.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean,
it's not necessarily, oh, right in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, I know lots of biracial, multiracial people, and we, like, even me and my siblings, there's a range of how dark and, like, we look, you know, and we have the same parents. But you brought up Trevor Noah's memoir.
Yeah, this makes me think of Born a Crime, which talks about he was considered, like, he was born in apartheid and considered illegal because he's mixed race. And I think that I would assume, to your question, I would assume the answer is yes, because Kosa Don and Divine, under this current system, so from like the raid going forward,
right,
I wouldn't be surprised if Saran outlet that, because Kosa Don and Divine aren't allowed to have relationships or have sex in the first place.
Right.
And I think that's because he understands Magi and Diviners as being hereditary, and he doesn't want them to populate. But at the same time, it's not like Diviners are forced to be celibate.
No.
So you're not outlying the reproduction of people with magical abilities. And we see in the case of Anon, even between two Kosa Don.
We assume.
We think. We don't have information that tells us otherwise.
Right.
But the text does kind of insist that the reader see him as an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
If it's possible in him, then it'd be possible in anyone.
Right.
And doesn't Lacan say that it's not necessarily hereditary, that it's like the gods bless whoever they bless, and that's just how it is, and they don't think too much about it, but it's the Magi / Kosa Don outside of Chandomblé who kind of impose that legacy of hereditary magic.
Yeah, I don't really remember. I do know that, I read the synopsis for Children of Vengeance,
Virtue and Vengeance,
and it talked about how magic was with the people who had had it before, which is why Amari has magic, because her family used to.
I wonder how far does you just have to have like a tiny legacy, like a tiny little bit,
just like a one drop rule,
one drop.
I don't know, because I didn't understand that at the very end of the book. I thought everyone was going to have magic because they all come from the gods, but the synopsis for the second book made it seem like people who had had it in the past, their families might have it now. Because initially I thought that maybe Anon was not, didn't share the same mother as Amari, and that was why he had magic. But now I don't know.
Maybe one of them could be Kaya or Kaya's child. Never know.
Maybe that's why Amari's mom hates her so much. Maybe they don't have the same mom.
Oh, that's fair. Because it did talk about when in the part with Amari in the palace about the rumors that her mother wasn't actually
right.
Her mother.
And maybe she's not.
That could very well be. That would be an interesting twist.
So pretty much all of chapter 45 for me was heartbreaking, but also really speaks to empathy coming from, you know, white people. So Kelly's going to read pages 314 to 315 for us, and then we're going to talk about it.
Okay. Zaylee's pain falls through the air like rain. It sinks into my skin. My chest heaves with her sobs. My heart rips with her anguish. And all the while, I feel a terror unlike anything I've ever known. It crushes my soul. It destroys all will to live. This can't be her world. This can't be the life Father built. But the longer her pain grips me, the more I realize. This fear is always there. If your guards were here, everything would just be we'd be just as broken, just as hopeless. There's no living under their tyranny. Our only salvation is power. As soon as the words leave her mouth, Zaylee's sobs quiet. It's like she's remembered a deeper truth, a way to escape the pain. Your people, your guards, they're nothing more than killers, rapists, and thieves. The only difference between them and criminals is the uniforms they wear. She pulls herself to her feet and palms the tears from her eyes. Fool yourself all you want, little prince, but don't feign innocence with me. I won't let your father get away with what he's done. I won't let your ignorance silence my pain. With that, she disappears. Her quiet footsteps fade into the silence. In that moment, I realize how wrong I've truly been. It doesn't matter if I'm in her head. I'll never understand all her pain.
So this was a really powerful chapter for me, thinking about white supremacy, thinking about white feminism, because I think we see this a lot today where people, they say that they know what it feels like to be a Black person in America. And I'm just going to talk about that. And I think that sometimes people experience microaggressions, not on a day-to-day basis, but like little things. Like we see it with white feminists, and they feel a tiny piece of what Black people have felt for so long, because they're very concerned with rights being taken away from them. And I agree. Obviously, women should have a choice in their government. They should have a voice there. But I think sometimes it ignores the fact that they don't participate in the needs and the wants of Black people. So we think about, like, the Women's March, which I think is a great thing. Like, of course women deserve rights. They deserve equal rights. But those same people are not marching in the streets for Black Lives Matter. Those same people are not protesting police officers when children are being shot in the street, when Black people are dying. And to me, that chapter encapsulates that feeling that I feel so well. And that was a hard chapter for me to read. It was real painful, but it was just so, so true.
Yeah, I think it's important for people, especially with racial privilege, white people, to toe the line and not try and conflate, like, a logical knowledge of, like, facts or statistics or stories or anecdotal knowledge with experiencing it in your own body every single minute of every single day of your life.
Right.
Just because I was the only white person in the waiting room at the doctor's office this one time doesn't mean that I get it. Or just because I experienced an oppressive or a microaggression based on my gender doesn't mean that I experienced it. Like, misogynoir, like what Black women and women of color experience, is very different than what I experience as a white woman. And not to mention, like, a cis white woman. Like, I think this, it just makes a case for empathy, but without trying to take over the narrative. As the person with privilege, you should be elevating voices. That's what true allyship and or what being an accomplice really means, I think. And a lot of it's about listening for me. And so reading this chapter, it's totally, I will never understand what that's like.
Right. And I think in some ways that's hard for me too, because, like, people who look like me, because I'm light skinned, are not getting shot by police officers. Like, we don't see, like, light skinned people going through the same things as darker Black people do. So I don't want to take on a voice saying that I understand what that's like either. But for me, I just thought this chapter was really powerful in talking about, like, what it means to be an ally, like, what it means to actually want to help people means that you help them even when there's no benefit for you. Like, there's no benefit in a white woman, like, taking part in a Black Lives Matter march, or protesting the killing of a Black child. But if you're an ally and you actually believe that what the police are doing is wrong, killing innocent people, then you have to stand up for those groups even when you don't get anything from it.
Right. Only advocating for people that look like you is how the world stays so fucked up for exactly. So long.
Yeah, definitely. And then I do think that Adeyemi makes a good point. I think she's trying to convey those feelings. On page 312, this is Zele. She says, I am always afraid. It's a truth locked away years ago, a fact I fought hard to overcome, because when it hits, I'm paralyzed. I can't breathe. And I think that's something we can take away directly from, like, police brutality. Like, I can't breathe. Like,
oh my, yeah. You know? Eric Garner.
Yeah. So, I think if you read this and you don't see these things, like
you're reading it wrong.
You're reading it wrong. And also, like, you don't know what's going on in the world at all. Like, it's just, you have to pay attention, you know?
And it's okay if you're at a different point in your journey, right? To understanding how systems of oppression work and how they affect people of different races and genders, et cetera, and different intersectional identities. And we see that displayed in the book, actually, with the Amari-Zaylee conflict.
Right.
Whereas Zaylee is so mad that Amari hasn't been actively fighting against this.
Right.
Amari's just starting.
Right.
When she sees Binta die, it changes her fundamentally. And Zaylee's mad and claps back at her and snaps at her, but that's also fine. Zaylee doesn't owe civility right. to Amari at all.
Yeah. And so it's like, I would highly recommend Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race as well, because I do think that part of the problem, and I'm not sure it's a problem, but the burden of teaching always falls on the minority person. So like, Black people are forced to teach white people like about Black oppression and systemic racism. Gay people are forced to teach people about like what it means to be like not allowed to rent an apartment, or transgender people what it's like not to be allowed in a bathroom. Like, some of it's just common sense, but I do think that sometimes it helps to know the history behind those things, like where it comes from. So
at this point, I think
the internet exists.
Yes, I know. The information is so at your fingertips, and that's why I make sure to curate my social media so I'm hearing from
right.
from Black women in particular, like Rachel Cargill on Instagram and She Rose and all these people who actually do the labor. They're Black women
right.
who do the labor of explaining things to. They have a big white. I guess they have a lot of white feminists that follow them.
Right.
And so people who are like, no, but like not all men, like not all women, not right. all white women.
Yeah. And I get that. Like, we all know.
Like, I get it.
Yeah. But like, also you have to recognize that like women of color have been pushed to the fringes of feminism. They've gotten pushed to the fringes of the Me Too movement. Like, you have to realize that, like
Tyrone Burke exactly. created the Me Too movement.
Yeah, exactly. And like, people don't know who she is, but they know who like Ashley Judd is. Like, famous white women just get to take that over, and now it's their movement. And that's why I really like very strong allies like Jessica Chastain or Emma Watson, who are like, no, you need to know who these people are. Like, we need this equality for them, not for us. And I really appreciated that in this book.
Yeah. Start reading. Start using the internet.
Yeah, the internet has answers to all kinds of questions. Like, and also, if a Black person or a person of color or a gay person or a trans person, if they don't want to explain it to you, then you need to respect that.
They don't owe you
no.
their time and emotional labor doing that for you.
Yeah, because it's a burden to do that. And yeah, no one wants to walk around with that all the time. Some people have to. On page 407, this is Zaylee talking when she is being tortured by Saran. She says, "For a moment I ponder whether Mama Agba's constant lashings weren't meant to punish but to prepare. She beat me so often I got good at taking it." And when I read this, I thought about Black-on-Black crime. I thought about the stereotypes of child abuse within Black culture. But I also think it really stems back to this belief that Black people have to be twice as good in order to even come close to their white counterparts in the world. Read Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates if you haven't. And I think a lot of times, and Ta-Nehisi talks about this in his book, that parents use physical abuse, Black parents, as a way to prepare their children for the harsh realities of the world. They will beat them so that they can escape from police brutality. If you beat your child enough, then they won't do bad things that will have the police stop them, as if it's not really just because of their skin color.
It's out of fear.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Because, like, of course, a Black child walking down the street is terrifying to people for some reason. So I thought that this was another way that Adeyemi brings up like the difficulties of Black culture, because I think that need to do that is like ingrained. And Ta-Nehisi talks about in his book about how he hit his child once and never did it again because he decided that's not the way to teach your child. But the need to be twice as good really stuck out to me in this part. On page 486, this is Zelle again saying, reality told us we would fail, but again and again we fought, we persevered, we rose. And I thought this was a good metaphor for the struggle for race equality. And while I don't think that we're there yet, I hope that, you know, books like this, stories like this, give people hope that we can in the future.
I agree. I think that the book, like I said earlier in the beginning of the podcast, when we started recording, that it balances this, it really does develop what the violence and oppression looks like. And it is, but there's also this like tenacious hope for liberation, and Zaylee fights, they all fight for it.
And it gets really hard sometimes where she thinks, I'll have to give up. Like, I don't have what it takes.
Right. But the fight is almost inevitable.
Right. It was going to happen either way.
And certain people are fighting just by surviving, like Baba.
Right.
Because he has so much physical and emotional and mental trauma after his beating by the guards. And right. So he needs a lot of support. But I think that that's the diversity of tactics and is important then in this way I think that's why it just shows how there's, to certain people, the fight for liberation is so necessary. And that's, it's such a, I mean, it's inevitable because that's what you were born into.
Right.
Like, you were born into the fight.
Right.
You didn't choose it. It chose you.
Yeah. And it's hard too, because like, you can't even be content to not fight, because it will show up on your doorstep eventually. Like, you will feel the ramifications of systemic racism in some way, shape, or form at some point in your life.
Because you exist.
Because you exist.
As a racialized person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's literally no avoiding it at all, which is interesting. So better to fight than to do nothing.
Main thing I wanted to talk about with class is inevitably connected to race, because intersectionality. Thanks, Kimberly Crenshaw and other pioneering Black feminists, for your work. And this novel dramatizes the interconnectedness of racial oppression and class oppression. So the diviners have to pay more taxes, specifically because they're diviners, because of their identity. And then when those taxes get raised and the diviners can't pay, they then become imprisoned, which is enslaved. And in this text, the two are practically the same thing. And we talked about that a little bit before, but in the real world, the two are practically the same thing. I mean, that's hence Watch the 13th, the documentary. And the racially oppressed stay poor because of the legacy of enslavement and imprisonment. And the Netflix has a good 15-minute racial wealth gap documentary that goes into the legacy of enslavement and how that actually manifests in the, like, with wealth or lack thereof within Black communities and communities of color, and hence why reparations are a really valid thing to consider.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's interesting because when you think about wealth in America, especially, the richest people we see have been rich for generations, and we don't see that as much in Black people because their ancestors were enslaved. Like, 1864, that wasn't that long ago, you know? What is it, 150 years?
Yeah.
Since, like, our ancestors were literally working for free. No money. Like, how do you even have...
They were money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were used as money. Like, it's just... Like, how do you even begin to break down that gap without reparations?
And there's a Martin Luther King Jr. quote that we can put in the show notes, but that talks about that I think actually the Netflix documentary ends on this. Like, how do you justify a race where one person has had a 150-year head start?
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, 150-year head start is like
barely scratching the surface.
Yeah, exactly, of what's going on, because then you have to add on Jim Crow time for that. You know, like, you can't have the same jobs, you can't live in the same neighborhoods. Like, yeah, I don't even know.
And then the housing discrimination that was happening in the 50s.
Exactly. And I'm sure, and like, even the wage gap, because you hear about the wage gap for women a lot, but it doesn't scratch the surface of, like, the wage gap between races, you
right,
know?
For indigenous women, or for Black women, or for, like, Mexican or Latino or other exactly. Latin women from Latin America.
Yeah, so it doesn't even talk about how, like, that affects the money we have.
Let alone the ability to get hired at all, because right. It's been shown that unconscious bias, if you put a Black sounding name
yeah, exactly.
on a exact same resume as like Karen, white name par excellence, they hire Karen.
Right, exactly. So what do? Then do you have to like change your name, or at least put a different name on an application just to be at the same level as a Karen? As a Megan. I like to
Becky?
Call them Megans. Ooh, don't get me started on Becky. Becky with the good hair. No, thank you.
That's loaded. That's a loaded lyric.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Jesse's gonna start us off talking about gender.
Zaylee is kind of a picture of non-normative femininity. She has a proclivity toward violence. She's protective of her family, but not in a way that feels maternal, more in like a violent way. She has a lot of rage, and I'm not sure, but she could be seen as representative of the stereotype as of an angry Black woman. I really liked how violent and angry she was. I thought it made sense.
It struck me as completely 100% justified.
Yeah, exactly.
And I hadn't thought of her in those terms. Like, it didn't come to mind that way, the angry Black woman stereotype. But
that's good. It means you don't like uphold those stereotypes, which is great. Kelly's awesome.
I think that's certainly like a valid, I think part of her could be seen that way because she has so much rage and she doesn't hold back. And then I mentioned earlier the relationship with Amari, but she doesn't do civil.
No.
Really. Not with the guards/police officers, not with any authority figures, really.
Not with her classmates.
Yeah, not with her classmates, not with Amari, not with Inan. No one.
No. I don't support violence. Let me just say that up front.
And it's fine. And it's good. Like, it's totally fine that Zaylee doesn't do civil, quote
right.
unquote, because white fragility, aka in this text, Kosidon fragility, can like fuck off.
Yeah, for sure. She needs to be strong in order, like, we couldn't have had a quote unquote weak female character in this role because I don't think she would have made it as far as Zaylee did. Like, I think that we're supposed to see Amari as her foil and that she is seen as like weak and frail, and almost like Zaylee teaches her how to be strong. Like, she already had that in her, obviously, because she's obviously a warrior. Like, once she realizes she needs to, she's willing to fight. But I think a little bit Zaylee showed her that it's okay.
Zaylee is just so much more. She's in a certain way has had freedom that Amari hasn't,
right,
to like see the world, because Amari was essentially stuck, like not allowed out of their palace, and her behavior was so much more policed. Oh, I shouldn't use that word, that's the wrong word to use. Her behavior is so much more controlled, and by her mother specifically, and these like court norms and behaviors that are expected of Amari. And so in a sense, like, Zaylee has actually had the space, despite her the multiple ways in which she's oppressed, she's actually had the space to develop that sort of relentless outward manifestations of strength. Whereas Amari shows strength, I think, in that when Anon, they keep coming back to the fight they had, and
right.
she keeps saying, and to her father keeps saying, strike Amari, and she plays that over and over and over again. And so I think actually Amari, the way that Amari is, her strength manifests, specifically when she's in that part of her life is by holding back, because that's what her father and her brother don't do. They use violence relentlessly because they have power, so that's why that violence is oppressive, right? But versus Zaylee is using violence from a position of oppression. And so I think Amari actually was being, that is a hallmark of her strength when she's in the palace context.
Right. And I wonder if Amari's kind of supposed to seem more maternal, because she does help take care of Zaylee, like with doing her hair and helping her get dressed. And she has like this relationship with Binta where, I mean, obviously Binta takes care of her, but something about her seems more like maternal to me, maybe.
I think.
And I don't think that equals weakness.
No. And I hadn't thought of it before, but hearing you say that makes me think that Amari almost takes on a Binta role for Zaylee.
Mm-hmm.
She's actually a person that Zaylee can communicate with and connect with. She provides companionship. She does those sort of caring labors like braiding her hair and nursing her back to health. And I think that she's almost fulfilling that role, which Amari totally really appreciates Binta for those sorts of behaviors and her companionship and being able to be close to her and her intimacy.
Which is interesting because she obviously doesn't learn those things from her actual mother, because her mother is the opposite of maternal. I don't even know what to call her. She's a bad mom.
Ooh. Yeah, she's just an authority figure. She doesn't care about her actual, like, the child, how they actually are, or getting to know that child, or letting them blossom into who they're going to be. She just wants a mini version of herself.
Yeah, and she has, like, these expectations for Amari, even though I'm not really sure what her mother expects of her, because Amari's not going to be the queen. I mean, she will now. She should be now.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was always going to be Inan, right?
Yeah, I think that was that's the impression I got. That's certainly what Saran was grooming Inan for. Because it was kind of, that's what it was going to be, because I get Inan is the older sibling.
Right.
And he's, assigned male at birth, right? And he's
right.
Identifies that way, as right. far as we know. So there was never a question as far as who was going to get the throne.
Maybe her mother was grooming her to be a good wife, which is also an awful thing.
Problematic.
Yeah, it's really problematic. You can be whatever kind of wife you want to be, as long as you don't, like, hurt people.
Or, like, don't be a wife. That's totally fine.
Yeah, what if she doesn't want to? I mean, I think she likes Zane, but that shouldn't matter. They don't have to get married.
Exactly. They can just be together or not.
Yeah, that's up to them.
You had mentioned Zane's treatment of Zaylee. What did you want to say about that?
Oh, right. I forgot about that. So when Zane realizes that Zaylee likes Inan, that they like each other, he is pissed, like beyond pissed. And he calls her a whore, which is like beyond problematic, like to think that he gets a say over what she does with her body. And I was furious with Zane in that moment. And he had been a good brother up till then. He's a little too protective because she has been through a lot of shit, and some of it more so than he has.
I think they should just communicate, because then Zaylee feels guilty for all of that.
Right. And she shouldn't.
Like, she just drew a bad hand on a lot of these things.
Yeah. Like, what was she supposed to do? And also, it assumes that, I don't know. I'm not sure. I think that we have a choice in who we like. So for him to then say, well, you just can't, it's real shitty.
It is really shitty.
Yeah.
That protective bullshit can fuck off.
Yeah, I was pissed. Yeah, he was being a little shit.
Her body, her choice.
Her body, her choice. My favorite words.
Listeners, if you've read Children of Blood and Bone and haven't done the Magi Clan quiz, It's on childrenoftheblendandbone.com. Jesse and I took it right before starting recording. And I love a good sorting quiz.
What did you get, Kelly?
I got seer. But also want to temper this by saying, if this isn't for me, that's totally fine. And I won't be a member of any clan. And I'm not upset that it's not mine.
Thank you.
What did you get?
I got grounder, which...
How do you feel about that?
You know, it says practical and grounded and hardworking. So I think that kind of sounds like me. I wish I got something else, but...
What do you wish you got? Just say it.
Okay. I wish I got cancer so I could, like, kill all the bad people. But I'm also a Libra, and I have, like, a very distinct, like, black and white view of the world, so I'm not sure I should be allowed to have those powers.
Maybe it's better that you didn't get
sorted. I don't always see the gray, so maybe grounders for the best.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about sexuality, asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do shipping of our own.
I guess I just wanted to mention how we don't see any gay characters in this story. And I'll let you talk about what you think about that first before I add anything to it.
There are no gay characters. There is a same-sex intimacy between Binta and Amari. And I don't want to impose romance on a friendship. I don't think we get the sense that it's very tender, very intimate, very connected, but we don't, I mean, you could maybe see queerness there if you want to.
When I was looking up this book, one of the Goodreads questions was asking if it was an LGBTQIA, you know, if it lined up with that in any way. And someone said yes. And I was surprised after having read it that someone read it that way.
I don't think it actively pushes against that, of course. No. Like, not at all. I guess the Amari Binta would be perhaps the most LGBTQIA plus aligned relationship that we see.
Right.
It's just a lot of, like, female friendship, essentially. Like, the beautiful expansiveness that can be female friendship can be. And it's, but also so... for them behind closed doors, because they're literally not allowed to be in relationship with one another except for Binta being a servant and Amara being a master.
Like a forbidden friendship.
Yes.
Instead of a forbidden, like, romance. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Star-crossed friends.
Star-crossed friends. Why not?
Speaking of star-crossed friends.
Yeah.
Not friends. Speaking of star-crossed lovers.
Star-crossed lovers. I really liked Amari and Zane together. I thought they made the most sense. I don't think if I were in Zelly's shoes that I could ever be with Anon, because he's kind of a piece of shit, but...
He's a project boyfriend.
Yeah, and I'm too old for that. That's a young person's game.
I found the pairing off of the siblings a little... Lazy. Convenient.
Convenient.
The Amari Zane ship strikes me as the more sustainable one.
Yeah.
I think that there is a lot of chemistry between Anon and Zaylee. They're certainly drawn to one another for some reason or another.
But it seems all physical, not really, maybe not more there than that. Not that that's not okay.
Yeah.
But
I think a lot of it is Anon searching for something.
Right.
Searching for connection that he's never been allowed to have. And honestly, I think he's drawn to her because she's so unapologetically magic, read black, then he hates that part of himself. And so I think that he's almost maybe making up for the void. Maybe that's the reason he's attracted to her so much, is because of her. She embraces that part of herself.
And she's so strong. She's such a strong person, which is what his father wants from him. So
yeah, he sees in her maybe the unrelenting strength that he can't have, or he sees himself as being weak by being okay with magic,
right?
And by using magic to further his very Can we say problematic for like the 20th time? Problematic
yeah.
ends.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I do want to mention talking about queerness is that there, and this goes hand in hand with queerness and race. I don't think you should insert anything into a book just for the sake of it. Like, we don't want tokenism. No, thank you.
No.
But there is this stereotype and this feeling within the Black community against queerness. So it was also a little frustrating to me not to see any of it in this book that kind of is representative of the diaspora.
And that gives Black characters the emotional bandwidth and like the character development and nuance and complexity that white characters have always been allowed right. to have.
Exactly. So I feel like it would have been the perfect time to add queer characters.
I definitely hold out hope for
right.
the rest of the series. I think it's totally possible that yeah. that's coming down the pipeline.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me at all because Eddie Amy is like so... You can tell that she actively fights against stereotypes and
yeah.
and wants to show the breadth of experience.
Yeah. So I guess I see why maybe it wasn't in this book, because this book wasn't really about romance. But I will say I'm glad there was romance in this book, because it shows that even in the midst of terrible circumstances, we're allowed to feel our feelings, and that like Black love is beautiful. Like Black girl magic, Black boy joy, like all of those things are encapsulated in this book, and I was really happy about that.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Sexy times.
Yeah. Pretty tame. Like a let's zoom out and like pan out kind of thing on anything that could have been.
It was like a yeah, times. Exactly, the fade away.
Yeah, exactly. Like on a scale from 1 to Sarah J. Maas, like, it's a 1. I mean, like, everything is, but...
I'm hoping that that any of the characters really get to experience that more in the other books of the series, that they get to come into their own in that regard, too, because it was very much about, like, coming into their own as Magi.
Right.
And they are more than that.
Right.
Just like how Black people are more than their Blackness, yeah, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it would also be good, too, because it would be good to have seen a sexual experience that isn't jaded by Zelie's pain, like everything awful that's going on, since it happened like right after, like kind of soon after her whole torture thing. All right, question time, Kelly. Can Zelie get pregnant from having sex with Anon in the dreamscape? What are your thoughts?
I think because neither of them are physically present in the dreamscape, like when Kaya or Kia, I really should learn how to pronounce her name, interrupts Anon when they're both at Chandomblé.
Right.
They're not having sexy times in the dreamscape at that point, but... He's there and he's like dreaming and there's like a blue cloud around his head or something, or he's right. glowing.
Mm-hmm.
She says he's glowing. So he's, and then Zelie, I think, obviously stays physically present in her reality too.
Right.
So it's basically just like the best sex dream.
The most realistic
sex dream ever.
Yeah. I wonder. Okay. I mean, I hope she doesn't. That would be problematic.
Yeah. I don't think that's possible.
So don't, but like, I just was like, I don't know, when I was thinking about this, I was like, huh, can she get pregnant? But like, maybe they were interrupted before. Things could finish anyways. I don't know.
Nice pun.
Finish.
We have finished talking about race representation and of gender and class, etc. And we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment that we call Kill Your Darlings.
Unlike in other fantasy and YA books, usually written by white people, there was no skirting around race of characters, and Black is shown as being beautiful in this book, and I really, really enjoyed that.
Black is the default, and that's wonderful. white. Yeah. The whiteness is what is actually called out a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah. That's all I have to say really about like writing style. We don't get any of this like you can assume the race of a character in this book, because even Rowan is described, like his race is described.
Right. It's just kind of dismantling this norm of just assuming.
Right.
Like it's okay. You can describe that as much as hair color or I don't know.
Like eye color, body type, like every other physical thing they characteristic. Describe. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that about this book.
Definitely. I thought it was fast paced.
I was having so much trouble because I wanted to keep reading, but I also needed to sleep so I could be a functioning person. So that was really hard. It was good.
Adeyemi covers so much ground, and her, so do her characters, right? They literally cover so much ground. There's a huge journey that happens in this book. There's so much traveling. We see, and in that regard, the capacity to imagine all of these different types of geography, all these different types of people, all these different types of magic, all these different interactions, so many different plot twists. I thought that was incredible.
Right. And she's very descriptive. Like, I never once was reading and thought, I can't picture this. She did a really good job of describing, especially because Orisha has so many different landscapes. Like you talked about earlier, like there's desert, there's rainforest, there's mountains, and you can, like when you're traveling along, you can really see all the places they are.
And I think that what it does is it disrupts this stereotype of Africa, right? As if people say that's like a country.
As if like all of it is plains and lions and whatever, elephants.
You basically have Serengeti. You have like three options. You have Serengeti. Mm-hmm. Jungle,
right,
or desert.
Yeah.
And and there's mountains, like the temples in a mountainous region. We have Ilorin, which is the like this coastal city,
right,
where Zaylee and Zane live after the raid.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I thought she did a good job making it seem like probably what Africa is like it's a diaspora. Like there are different places, there are different people, there are different cultures, and I feel like we really see that in this book.
Absolutely. Anything else to say about writing style? I mean, I've already like sung her praises as far as like characterization.
Yeah, she did a great job with the characters, and they all, sometimes I find in fantasy that certain characters will seem similar, like maybe we don't need them all. And she does a good job of making all the characters very distinct. Like, there's not a character that I would say, yeah, we could get rid of them. I liked that.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And I thought the characters were actually really unique.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily conflate one with an archetypal character like Hermione or Draco.
Or, like, even sometimes I wasn't paying enough attention, so I didn't see whose POV we were on, but you could tell from the reading whose POV we were on.
That's a good point. The voices, because it's a different, there's three different points of view, I think, that we access in this book, right?
I think so.
And you could absolutely tell developing the voice of each of those characters, which it's hard enough to develop your own voice as a writer, let alone like the character, the voice of three distinct, radically distinct characters.
Right.
I'm excited to read more.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I have no idea what's going to happen in the next book, but I'm like, I wish I didn't read it already so that I could, like, have the next one to read.
Totally. Recommend if you like. I'm going to start with Avatar The Last Airbender. Fans of Avatar The Last Airbender will really enjoy this book because there's bending, the different elements, and so we're in Avatar... We're talking about not James Cameron. Go away, James Cameron. But in the TV series, the bending, so like the magic, is very connected to religion, to the religion they practice. But instead of incantations like we see in Yoruba and Children of Blood and Bone, in Avatar The Last Airbender, they're more physical. You're moving your body in certain ways that call up the different elements in these different manifestations. And so basically there's a lot of interesting similarities between how the magical systems work and how the magic manifests with Avatar The Last Airbender. And it was, it also has like the vibrant, expansive world that that series has, where you see a lot of different like corners of that world. That's what I would start with. Fans of Avatar The Last Airbender will love it.
I think if you like travel stories, you will like this book. Similar to Harry Potter, this has three characters going on a journey together. We're going to gender swap those characters. And we have this book. And I really, really like that.
And like put black people in it.
Black people and like really strong female characters who are not like pushing their agenda on other people.
I would say that almost the extent of the similarities is that there are three characters. They go on a journey. They have to collect magical items and they do a thing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much. So it's kind of like, I mean, like Lord of the Rings is like that as well. Yeah. So.
And I saw an article that said, it was some headline that said, is Tomi Adeyemi the next J.K. Rowling? And I was like, I get really bristly when things like that come up. It's like how some newscaster said to Simone Biles, like, it's like you're the Michael Phelps of gymnastics. And she's no, I'm the Simone Biles of gymnastics.
Yeah. Like, we don't always need to be comparing ourselves to, like, our counterparts, especially when they're not, like, in your field.
Yeah, Adeyemi's in another league.
Yeah, for sure. But I think if you like those travel stories, like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, well, really just Seven, then you'll like this story.
And I would say this book is generally a must read. Like, I'm buying every edition that comes out. I hope that there are full color, like, illustrated editions. I will buy 10 tickets to see this movie. I am totally on board.
Yeah. If you liked Black Panther, if you read The Hate U Give and were very excited to see diverse cast, if you read Dear Martin, like, if any of those things speak to you, then you're going to love this book.
And I also think white people need to read this book and buy this book and recommend it to other white people that you know.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of Ship It by Britta London, which is our first fantasy adjacent episode. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JK Magic Pod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag #CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on Apple Podcasts, Google Play /podcasts, and Stitcher. If you're feeling benevolent, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show, particularly on Apple Podcasts. See you in a fortnight. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to Ute, Cheyenne, and Arapaho Indigenous peoples. Just have to call settler colonialism for what it is.